Welcome back to the Series 7 Study Guide. Over the last year or so, as time has allowed me, I've been working on another audio course, and that's for the Series 63 exam. Once you pass the Series 7 exam, you're going to have to pass a few other exams, and the Series 63 is one of those. The Series 63 deals primarily with state regulation and state oversight of investment advisors and broker-dealers. So today, I'm going to offer one sample, and that's the only sample that I'm going to offer on this series of lessons, and this is for the Series 63 exam. Now, the audio course, the full audio course, is only available at my website, theseries7podcast.com, and I will put a link to the full series of lessons in the show notes. So now there are two audio courses available at the website, the Series 63 and the Series 7 study courses for those examinations. Now, unlike the Series 7 audio course, which are available in iTunes and Amazon and CD Baby, in addition to the website, the Series 63 probably will not be offered on Amazon or in iTunes or in CD Baby. It's only going to be available at the website. So if it's something that's of interest to you, you can check out a detailed description of the lessons at the website and see if it's something that's appropriate for you. With that out of the way, let's get on to the sample lesson for the Series 63 exam. This is a Series 63 study guide. This is Business Practices, Customer Accounts, Part 2. Now remember, this is going to be the largest portion of questions that you're going to get in the Series 63. So make sure you study business practices extensively. Don't just listen to this audio course. Also, go read the books, practice some examinations. Make sure you understand it. So let's talk about anti-fraud rules for a minute. So if you're compensated in any way as to the value of securities, advise clients, you recommend stocks to clients, well, first of all, you cannot use any scheme to defraud that client. So you can't put out a newsletter that is false. Or you can't make false claims to a client about the prospects of a company that you're recommending. And this is an area that can be interpreted pretty broadly. So any device or scheme to defraud is flat out illegal. All right. Continuing on with anti-fraud, it's flat out illegal to do a transaction for a customer as a broker or a dealer without obtaining the consent of the customer before the transaction takes place. You have to get the client's consent before you do a trade. Now, we talked about that in the last lesson as well, so let's reiterate that. Before you do a trade for a customer as a broker or a dealer, you must obtain the consent of that customer. Now, if you're a registered investment advisor and you have discretionary authority, that rule does not apply. And, of course, you can't operate a fraudulent business. You can't hold out your shingle to be a broker-dealer and not actually fall within the rules of a broker-dealer under the Securities and Exchange Act and all the other various rules and regulations that actually regulate securities dealers. So you cannot fraudulently be a broker-dealer. Now, I see this quite often, and here's typically how it goes. So here's how I've seen this fraudulent activity occur in the past. And this comes from real-world experience. Not my experience, my client's experience. A few years back, my business partner had a client, went to church. And at church, there was a new member that had just joined the congregation. He drove a nice new car, lived in a nice new house. People were curious as to how he made his money, so people started asking him questions. Hey, how do you make your money? He says, oh, I trade the stock market. You know, I make 1% a day. It's pretty much what I do. I make about 1% a day. And people said, wow, that's pretty good. That's really good. Of course, if you figure out 1% a day, that's pretty much mathematically impossible to make 1% a day for any significant period of time. He'd pretty much end up with all the money in the world in, I don't know exactly how long, but not too long. So that is pretty much a fraudulent claim right there. my business partner's client says, geez, I'd like to see what you do. He says, oh, come on over to my house. I'll show you. He went down to his room. It showed a lot of flashing lights, computer screens, various screens, graphs, charts on various computer screens. He really had the razzle dazzle down there. Okay, I said, well, I'll handle some of your money if you want me to. It's, but only if you really want me to. And of course, he's taken in by the show, basically. Gave him some money. And of course, it was a typical Ponzi scheme. Now, first of all, the person taking the money was violating all sorts of statutes. Firstly, he was not a broker-dealer. He couldn't take somebody's money and do trades for that person. He wasn't following any of the rules and regulations. So he was basically defrauding clients, defrauding customers. He was not a broker-dealer. He did not fall under the rules and regulations. He made, he employed devices to defraud people. So it happens. There's scam artists out there. So this is a area of the rules and regulations that are designed to catch those people. Now, interestingly enough, we called up the state SEC and reported this individual, and they eventually did come down on him. So this really doesn't apply that much to legitimate broker-dealers. If you're working for one of the big broker-dealers, they are following the rules and regulations. But just so you know, let's go through this again. You can't employ any device to defraud an individual. You must get consent before you do a transaction for a client if as a broker dealer, but not necessarily as a registered investment advisor that has discretionary authority. You can't engage in any unethical practices. And unethical is going to be defined by the administrator. All right, let's go on to the next section of this. What's required in a contract? An advisory contract. Has to be in writing, has to have a fixed life, has to detail whether the fee is paid in advance or arrears, and it has to detail what happens if a client has paid in advance, his fee in advance, and he terminates the contract before that period is up. How does the advisor pay back that client for his unearned fee, basically? So let's say you have a contract, you bill quarterly in advance. So the beginning of the quarter comes around, you bill the client 3 months in advance. A month and a half goes by, and the client says, I no longer require your services. I'm terminating our contract. Well, then the investment advisor needs to refund that 50% of unearned fees. He needs to prorate, and it needs to be in writing how he's going to prorate the fees that are reimburse the client should the contract be terminated prior to the ending of the earning cycle. So, contract has to be in writing, has to have a fixed life, 2, 4, 6 years. How is the advisory fee going to be paid? Is it going to be quarterly, semi-annually, annually? Is it going to be upfront or in arrears? And if it's upfront, how is the client going to be refunded his unused advisory services? Now, if you have a contract as an advisor with a client, you cannot assign that contract to somebody else without the client's approval. If you're an investment advisor, as a general rule, you cannot share gains or losses with a client. But most advisory contracts are based on a percentage of assets. So a typical investment advisory contract would say, the investment advisor is paid 1% of assets under management. So in that case, if the assets go up in value, of course, the investment advisor does gain from the growth in those assets. So that is allowed. But if you say, okay, as an investment advisor, I'm going to share 20% of the gains and not take any of the losses, that's not allowed. Now, hedge funds can do that. And wealthy clients can be charged a performance fee. But those are exceptions, not the rules. So you can have a fee based on assets under management, but you can't have a compensation system in general that's based on capital appreciation. except for the overall growth or decline of the portfolio. So in that case of 1%, if the assets decline by 1%, of course, the investment advisor is going to make less money because he's getting that 1% on a smaller base. Usually these are recalculated quarterly or semi-annually or annually, and that has to be in the contract. How are you going to be compensated? What are the terms? Now, wealthy individuals, defined as either $1 million of assets under management or $2 million of net worth, can pay a performance fee. This is according to the Investment Advisor Act of 1940, which states that this is possible. And in this case, federal law applies, not state law. So there is a conflict between federal law and state law. Federal law applies in this situation. State law, NASAA rules, state that if an advisor charges a performance fee, it must be in writing, and that the advisor is going to get compensation based on both unrealized and realized gains, and it must detail how they're going to value illiquid investments. What's going to be the computation method for valuing illiquid investments? And what terms are going to be used in valuing these liquid investments and paying the performance fee? Also, it must state that the fee arrangement may create an incentive for the advisor to take riskier or make riskier investments. That has to be disclosed right up front in the written contract. So the client knows, okay, I'm going to pay you a lot to take a lot of risks. If you win, you get paid additional compensation, and you're going to share in the gains. It has to be in writing, has to be understood. One thing you can always say about almost all rules is disclosure, 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 full disclosure. Usually, a performance fee is going to be based on a comparison to an index. And so the advisor may say, hey, as long as I exceed the Standard Poor's 500 or whatever index he chooses, if I exceed it by X percent, then I share in the upside by a certain percentage. So in the advisory agreement, the index is going to be indicated, and the reasons that index is chosen has to be explained. What's the significance of the index? Why does the advisor believe that the index is a good index to use as a benchmark? Now, when you studied for the Series 7 examination, you studied 12B1 fees. That's okay. 12B1 fees are approved in the Series 63, but it's capped at 0.75% annually. Typically, registered investment advisors may choose to use a wrap fee. This is pretty common, where the commissions, the transaction fees, and the management fee are all wrapped together in one fee, so a client is not concerned about excessive transactions in the account. It can be either way. You can either have an investment advisory agreement that charges a percentage of assets under management, and then the client pays the transaction charges, or you can wrap it all into one fee. Either is okay as long as it's disclosed. There's soft dollar agreements between brokerage firms and advisory firms. Typically, an investment advisor is independent. He doesn't act as a broker-dealer. So he can choose to do the trades with whatever broker-dealer he wants to deal with. So he might send some business over to Merrill Lynch. He might send some business over to other brokerages. And in return, these brokerage firms may give him some free research. They don't discount the trades, but he gets some free research. Is this okay? Well, it is okay as long as you can prove that the givebacks benefit the advisor's clients and not the advisor. Investment advisors are fiduciaries. This is a big difference. Investment advisors are fiduciaries and have to act as fiduciaries. So if they enter into these soft dollar arrangements, they must be able to demonstrate that it's for the benefit of the client and not for the benefit of the investment advisor. Broker-dealers, on the other hand, who collect commissions for trades, are not considered fiduciaries. When an investment advisor signs up a new client, it's required that that new client receive an investment advisor brochure. This brochure is going to give him information about the broker-dealer, the key personnel. Also, it's going to include the ADV Part 2A and the ADV Part 2B. The ADV Part 2A gives information about the business of the advisor, and the Part 2B gives information about the personnel that work for the company and other information. These must be delivered to the customer. So these brochure deliveries, let's talk about how long a client has to look at this ADV Part 2A and ADV Part 2B. So there's a couple ways to look at this. Let's say you have a client that comes into your office. You set up a new account with him. He's hiring you as an investment advisor, a fee-based investment advisor. You've got the written agreement. You've got the client agreement. You give him the ADV Part 2A and the ADV Part 2B. Customer has 5 business days after being presented with these to terminate the agreement without penalty. Now, the other way around this is you say, okay, you're going to be coming into the office in 3 or 4 days. Here, I'm going to send the ADV Part 2A to you and the ADV Part 2B to you. Look them over before you come into the office. As long as a client has at least 48 hours before entering into the contract, that's enough prior notice. So you can either give it to him 2 days in advance, or if he signs it when he's in your office, he has 5 days to terminate the agreement. Either way. Now, this is in conflict with the SEC rules, Investment Advisor Act of 1940. It's not required to have this prior to entering into an investment advisory contract. So the NASAA rule and the SEC rule are in conflict in this situation. So clarify that. The SEC rule does not require the 2-day look before or the 5 days to rescind. NASAA rules do require it. An investment advisor at the end of the year has to update any filings, the brochures, the ADV Part 2A and the ADV Part 2B annually. And it has to be filed within 120 days of the advisor's physical year end. And that's the same as the SEC rule. Let's say you choose to send a brochure, which is the ADV Part 2A and the ADV Part 2B, to a client with a PDF document. That's okay. It can be done either through the mail or electronically. Either way is okay. Quite often, investment advisors create their own brochures as long as that brochure contains the information of the ADV Part 2A and the ADV Part 2B, that's fine. There may be additional information in addition to just those two portions. There's some rules in here that are very confusing, and it regards custody of clients' assets. As a general rule, it's prohibited for investment advisors to take custody of customer funds and securities. Normally, an investment advisor will use another broker-dealer to hold and take custody of a client's assets, and the investment advisor may place trades with that broker-dealer, and that broker-dealer may send funds out to the client and pretty much just act at the instructions of the investment advisor, as long as it's in writing and approved by the client. So, as a general rule, investment advisors do not take custody of clients' funds or securities. Then it gets fairly complicated at that point in time. If an investment advisor wants to take custody of funds or securities, the NASAA requires that it must notify the administrator in writing and on form ADV, and the administrator we're talking about is the NASAA, that it wants to take custody of these clients' assets. And it must do it for each state that he wants to take custody of the assets. It must be held by a qualified custodian. And the qualified custodian must keep a separate account with each client's name, or in accounts that hold funds and securities, held in the investment advisor's name as trustee for the custodian. This is really pretty confusing. quite honestly, the custodian rules. Who are qualified custodians under NASAA custody rules? Well, FDIC-insured deposit-taking institutions, registered broker-dealers, registered futures commission merchants, foreign financial institutions, which hold financial assets for customers. So what's considered taking custody? Prepaid advisory fees of $500 or more than 6 months in advance of the services rendered. An account that gives full power of attorney to the advisor, and it would also allow the advisor to take money out, withdraw funds. The prepaid fees of $500 is in conflict with the Federal Act, which has a higher level of $1,200. So the custody fees are very complicated. As a general rule, registered investment advisors do not take custody of clients' assets. They have those assets custodied at another broker-dealer or another financial institution. And they're very confusing. So let's say you're a registered investment advisor and you receive a check from a client and you don't take custody of clients' assets, but the client makes the check out to you or your firm. Well, as long as you don't cash that check and you send that check back to the client, you haven't taken custody of those assets. I have to tell my clients all the time, make the check out to the custodian, not to me. And then it gets deposited to the client's account at that custodian. Sometimes clients send you checks that are made out to third parties. They meant to pay their utility bill. And as long as you forward that check on to the utility company or the third party, within 3 days you haven't taken custody. Also, if a client makes out a check to you, you have to return that check within 3 days, so you do not take custody. The NASAA requires that each investment advisory firm updates its ADV registration within 90 days of the fiscal year end. If there's been a material change within the year, then it must file an amendment on the ADV within 30 days of that material change. And if there has been a material change within the year, the updated ADV, the amended ADV, must be provided to the clients within 120 days of the fiscal year end. So those are three different days required for each different type of event. Okay, so that finishes up this lesson of Series 63 Study Guide, Business Practices, Customer Accounts, Part 2. Thank you for listening. Again, if this is something that you think would be valuable to you in your study efforts, the full series of lessons are available at the website, series7podcast.com. Over the last few weeks, I've received one or two letters from people that have asked me about my audio course. And one of the letters went something like this: is this going to be all I need to study in order to pass a Series 7 exam? And my response is always the same: no, this is a supplement to your studies. You should be reading books, taking practice examinations, and this is just something that allows you to study in some of the time that would be wasted, such as driving or exercising. So it allows you to study in a different way. That's the same for the Series 63 audio lessons as well. None of these audio lessons will prepare you to take the exam. You need to do a lot more than just listen to some audio courses. You need to do practice examination, practice problems. A lot of these problems are going to require mathematics, and it's hard to do mathematics in an audio course. You're going to need to sit down with a piece of paper and work through some problems. So hopefully that answers some of your questions, and good luck in your studies.